I can't remember when it was. It must have been last year that you invited me to come, and you told me that the topic of the series was migration, politics, and political change. And I immediately thought, then I'm not the right person, because I don't really do politics, I thought. But then I started thinking about how there might be an overlap with my own research, and I found one partly by reconsidering what we mean by politics, and partly by sort of focusing on at the micro level, because I have been very interested in power relations between individuals, and how those power relations evolve in settings where institutions also play a role. So thanks to your invitation, I came to see some of my own work in a new light. And what I'll do in this talk is, in a way, to circle around this concept, the micropolitics of mobility and immobility, to try to think aloud together with you about what we might understand by that. So I'll say some general things first, and then I'll use four different examples from my own research. But it isn't like one paper based on a specific empirical project or something like that. It's more an exercise of thinking around concepts. So yeah, as I said, my first line of attack here was really to focus on politics. And it's striking, along with, I'm a geographer by training, and of course geography is a concept that's understood in very many different ways to mean different things, and the same is true for politics. And I found it quite inspiring to look at different attempts at defining politics. Some are exactly as you would expect about institutions and governance and so on, but I found at least three more open ones. That politics can be defined as the total complex of relations between people living in society, or the practice and theory of influencing other people, or social relations that involve the production and distribution of power. And then, of course, I realized, you know, I'm doing these things, it fits. But of course, it also adds something in terms of seeing my work in a different light. The last of these definitions is from an article by Tim Creswell, who happens to also be a sort of major theorist of mobility. He has a paper from 2010 called Towards the Politics of Mobility. And in that article, he has this definition, and he extends it a bit. So he says, first, by politics, I mean social relations that involve the production and distribution of power. And then, by a politics of mobility, I mean the ways in which mobilities are both productive of such social relations and produced by them. So he first says something about how he understands politics, and then that politics of mobility is a two-way relationship. And I'm quite fond of displaying things visually as a way of thinking, so I try to do that in this way, that he sees politics of mobility as this two-way relationship between mobility having an effect on social relations that involve the production and distribution of power, and vice versa, that these relations affect mobility. But when he talks about mobility, he talks about much more than what I talk about when I talk about mobility, because he's interested in not just the mobility of people, but also mobility of ideas and goods and lots of things, and also mobility of people in a much broader sense than we as migration scholars tend to think about it. Because even when we step outside the traditional concept of migration, we tend to think about relatively similar forms of mobility, such as visits to the country of origin. Even if it's not return migration, is significant if it's a shorter term visit. But of course, in mobility's research, there are also people working on things like commuting and aero mobilities and people with handicaps and mobility and lots of other things. So my idea about mobility and immobility here is more narrow. When Creswell talks about social relations, I discovered that he actually thinks only about relations between social groups, which to me is unnecessarily constraining, because I'm interested also in such relations as relations between individuals in some kind of social formation. So I've taken inspiration from this, but also moved on, distancing myself a bit from both his way of thinking about mobility and his way of thinking about social relations. So getting back to the topic and the title, there's the second important step from politics to micropolitics. And there I looked at how other migration researchers have used the idea of micropolitics. Because if you just look at micropolitics in general in the social science literature, it's very much still about organizations and institutions and how people navigate institutional structures. Of course, micropolitics can also mean something which isn't so tied to formal structures, but more about how individuals relate to each other and to the power relationships that sort of govern those interactions. So three articles stood out in what I found about the micropolitics and migration. One from 20 years ago by Melanie Knight, who wrote an article called Bangladeshi Immigrants in Italy, From Geopolitics to Micropolitics, where she looks at the way in which the relatively dramatic expansion of a Bangladeshi community in Rome, how that played out in terms of patron-client relationships, the formation of organization, and in a way the internal dynamics of the migrant community. So her approach to the micropolitics was very much about relations between migrants and other migrants, so within the migrant community. Another example of an article where the concept of micropolitics has been used is this one by Pecha Lan on negotiating social boundaries and private zones, the micropolitics of employing migrant domestic workers. She uses the idea of boundary work, the way in which people in different ways construct boundaries of meaning in their everyday lives, and she looked at, very specifically at the what she calls the domestic politics of food and space. So really at the micro level of what happens inside the house, how food is prepared and shared and eaten and so on, and how that serves to create and maintain and challenge boundaries that derive their meaning from this employer-employee relationship between a native employer and a migrant worker. The third example is an article by Valentina Mazzucato and Miriam Kapke, based on this Ghana Transnet project that Valentina had, I guess it must have been about a decade ago now, where Miriam was one of the PhD students. So they wrote one article called Small is Beautiful, the Micropolitics of Transnational Relationships Between Ghanaian Hometown Associations and Communities Back Home. So there, of course, they were moving a little bit into the institutional in the sense of looking at organizations, hometown associations as organizations, but their primary interest was in this transnational relationship between migrants and the people back home, and to some extent then between the associations and the migrants that the associations claim to represent. And from these three examples, I think we can move to sort of a general statement about what types of relationships between people do we talk about when we talk about the micropolitics of mobility and immobility. And I would argue that in most cases what's relevant are these three: relationships between migrants, relationships between migrants and natives in the sense of people who live in the destination country, and relationship between migrants and the non-migrants in the country of origin. So by sort of logical deduction from the concept of, or the context of migration, these are the three types of relationship that necessarily result from a migration setting. And incidentally, the three articles then focused on one type of relationship each. And I think this is actually quite very simple, but still very useful in terms of alerting us to the different types of relationships that might be important in migration processes. and also to think about the prior relationships of each type. But I'm interested specifically in the power relationships, not just in the relationships in the sense of who is connected to whom in a sort of social network sense, but really about the power relations of the connections between people. So I redraw it like this to emphasize that, you know, these are uneven relationships, maybe one way, maybe the other way, maybe both ways simultaneously in different contexts or settings, but they're not just a line between two individuals. So there's the sort of potential inequality and dynamism of the relationship that's obviously at interest when we talk about politics and micropolitics in particular. And then, there is the connection with mobility. And of course, there I agree with Creswell that we need to see mobility both as an influence on these power relationships and as a consequence of these power relationships. So here I'm getting towards the visual representation of the micropolitics of mobility and immobility. But this looks very, very sort of individualistic. And I think also the three articles that I pointed to illustrate that very often, even what goes on between individuals is very much conditioned by institutional settings. And here, again, I take a very sort of open approach to institutions. I'm not thinking about formalized organization necessarily, but also institutions in the sense of value systems, norms that govern people's behavior, and also affect the power relationships. Then the last element to problematize here is the mobility and immobility aspect. I found myself calling this talk mobility and immobility, so not using the migration word. And I guess that's mainly because mobility is a nicer complement to immobility than migration. But also because I sometimes feel it's nice to open up a little bit from migration as a sometimes too rigid a way of conceptualizing people's movement. But the point here is that there are some aspects of mobility and immobility that I think are interesting in general and particularly relevant to the context of micropolitics. The first is that, as Marike said initially, mobility and immobility are sort of relationally constructed in relation to each other. So in the way that one person's mobility can only really be fully understood in the context of other people's immobility and vice versa. And there, of course, it's immediately becoming political in the sense that relationships between people matter to how each person is positioned and the meanings of their behavior or possibilities. So there has been this trend to look at immobility not just as the absence of mobility, but also, for instance, as a conscious choice for some people. So that's very commendable, but I think it's also, from a sort of micropolitics perspective, nice to keep in mind this relational aspect of it, that one person's mobility is not only derives meaning from somebody else's immobility, but also is sometimes enabled by other people's mobility. So, for instance, you can migrate and lead a transnational life if someone else then stays back in your country of origin or community of origin and can sort of populate that node in your transnational life. The other aspect of migration that I think is important here is that migration is a constitutive form of mobility. And by that I mean that, unlike many other forms of mobility, such as commuting, and even going on holiday, migration does something to the moving subject. You become something by migrating. And of course we have the word migrant, and that you become a migrant when you migrate. And that I think is important in the sense that it shows how and why migration must be understood as something bigger or broader than the actual movement. And this constitutive aspect of migration can be uncomfortable, of course, in the sense that maybe you don't want to be seen as a migrant for the rest of your life just because you migrated at some point a long time ago. But even if it's not something that people necessarily want, it's a social fact that they are often perceived in that way. Also, I think some of the ethnographic studies on migration aspirations has shown how when people want to migrate, it's not necessarily because they want to be somewhere else, but because they want to be someone else. That by migrating, you become something that you are not as a non-migrant. So even before migration happens, there is this awareness of the constitutive aspect of it, in the sense that it's a process of becoming and not just mobility from A to B. The last point here is, I think, or I also argue that migration is a temporarily diffuse form of mobility, in the sense that the actual mobility might be extremely concentrated in time. We know, of course, that some of the people who are now coming to Europe have spent months and years on sort of on the way to Europe, but I think the majority of international migrants complete their migration in a day by plane. But still, it's an event that is significant over a much, much larger time span. So I've illustrated it like this, where we have this possibly, you know, in the context of time, really, really tiny moment of mobility, but then the significance of that mobility is much more drawn out in time, both in the sense that it can mark a sort of before and after distinction in the temporal dimension, but also that if we think of migration aspirations, the wish to migrate, as a way of relating to a possible future migration, we see that migration is significant in people's life much before it actually happens, and maybe it never happens, but it's still significant as a future possibility, and also afterwards, in the sense that, you know, when you have migrated, you are a migrant, it remains significant for the rest of your life. So this, I think, is part of the reason why it makes sense to think about migration and talk about migration, even though we are most of the time actually not talking about people moving, but things that go on around that movement. So that was the general reflections, and then I'll move to four specific ways of looking at this from different parts of my own research. So the first one is on the idea of involuntary immobility. Second one is on transnational relations. Third, on family migration histories. And lastly, on chain migration. So, yeah, please forgive me if you're fed up with this. Many of you know it. It's an article that I wrote in 2002, where I proposed what I call the aspiration ability model of migration, which took the very simple idea that in any population, basically in any population, there might be some people who have this wish to migrate, expressed as a feeling or thought that actually being somewhere else would be better than remaining where I am. So we could say that some people have the aspiration to migrate. But only some of those people will have the ability to actually go ahead and do it. So I became aware of this when I did fieldwork in Cape Verde, West Africa, which is an island country, very much sort of isolated from the rest of the world. So the distinction between staying and going was extremely stark, different perhaps from in many other countries where you could go to, you know, a different part of the country or to the neighboring country or further afield. In Cape Verde, it was really like either here or the rest of the world beyond the ocean. So this became very, very stark, but I think it still holds as a general idea. And the point here is that in order to explain and understand migration, we have to look at the processes that create migration aspirations, what makes people want to leave, and the processes that create migration ability, in the sense of enabling some people to actually move. So also in the context of the current crisis, we know that, you know, for every, say, Syrian who has actually managed to arrive in Europe, there are around 10 others who've fled their homes but haven't been able to move as far. So if we consider migration here as migration out of the region to Europe, there are very many people in this category who are stuck in the region, and also some, of course, who actually want to stay where they are in Syria, for instance, for different reasons. So this allows us to distinguish between the migrants who have both the ability and the aspiration to migrate, and the non-migrants who might or might not have the aspiration to go, but if they do, they don't have the ability. And it's this group that I'm interested in, the people who are convinced in some way that being elsewhere would be better, but they're not able to do it. And they are the involuntarily immobile. And this all relates to the micropolitics of mobility and immobility in the sense that it is, to some extent, I think a lot of the time, it's some form of feeling of powerlessness in relation to other people that underlies the wish to migrate. It is very often about generations or about social mobility in place. But my sense is that in most cases, it's in one way or another related to a feeling of being socially stuck, not being able to become who you want to become in the place where you are, whether that's about leading a normal and safe life, which it often is, or something more, in a way, bold and ambitious. And also this, it's a related form of powerlessness that makes it impossible for them to actually migrate. Because if we look at the barriers to migration that people have to face, it is very often about lacking the resources to move. Whether it's about having the money to pay a smuggler or knowing the people who can help you, which is an important fact not only in sort of economically motivated migration, but for instance, Nick in an old paper said I went as far as my money could take me in refugee migration, that you know, people's ability to move is very much constrained by their access to resources. So in a way we could say that it's being in this unfortunate position in relation to other people that both underlies the wish to move and the inability to actually move. And the other notable thing here is that in a situation of involuntary immobility, in a way, there is no migration. Nobody's moving. I call them involuntarily immobile, but the connection to migration is not, in a way, observably there. But still, I think it makes sense to think of them as immobile, precisely because other people are moving. So the idea of migration is there, but it's not just accessible for them. And again, it relates also to this temporal perspective that it's a case of migration being important before it happens. And maybe it never happens, but it's a future possibility. So this was perhaps the most sort of abstract connection to the micropolitics of mobility and immobility, but I think it still shows the importance both of this power relations aspect of it and the way in which migration matters, even if it's not directly observable. Then, moving on to transnational relations, this is perhaps where it's most clear that this is about politics at the micro level. I have been interested in transnationalism and different forms of conflict. Not in the sense of armed conflict, but in terms of sort of the micro-political conflicts between people. If we think of the transnational social field as encompassing two or more countries, but still a single social arena, I think there's a risk of sort of overemphasizing the unitary nature of it, because part of the reason why people are excited about transnationalism is that it goes against the idea that national societies are separate, and it shows that people can actually share the same social arena even if they're spread out. But even if they do share the same social arena, these real boundaries between countries are also boundaries inside the transnational social field. And it means that the people who populate that field are also differently positioned in relation to each other. And I've, like others, I've been interested in how we shouldn't really see transnationalism as something that immigrants do, and that's but something that immigrants and their non-migrant counterparts in the country of origin do together. And that, I think, is a recurrent weakness in the literature, that we tend to be very focused on the agency on the migrant side of things. And even if you look back at the early studies of transnationalism from the mid-1990s and the early definitions of transnationalism, it was explicitly described with reference to immigrants. Not emigrants, which would in many ways make more sense since we're talking about people's relationship to the country of origin, but transnational practices were seen as things that immigrants do, reflecting the fact that the people who studied these people were, for the most part, natives of the destination countries who saw them as precisely as immigrants. But I say we need to see them as emigrants as much as immigrants and really recognize this two-sided agency. And what I've been particularly interested in is how this two-sidedness is not one of equality, but one of different forms of asymmetries in the relationship between the people who left and the people who stayed behind. So here are examples. These are just photos for illustration, but exemplifying sort of a people who populate the same transnational social field, but at the different sides of it. So people who are left in the country of origin, such as Cape Verde, and who are in a destination community. And I'll use some quotes from my own fieldwork to illustrate how these relationships can play out in a way that I feel is absolutely micro-political. I mentioned the asymmetries in it, and my point there is that these asymmetries in the relationship are to a large extent intrinsic to the migration context, in the sense that when someone leaves and someone stays, that immediately places them in different positions in relation to each other. So they're both separated from the other, but there's a difference from being the person who left and the person who stayed behind. Also, I show that these relationships, because of the asymmetry, can be frustrating for both sides, and I'll show that with some quotes. And also that they are variable in the sense that it's not always the migrants or always the non-migrants who have the upper hand in the relationship, but it can be one or the other at different times or in different contexts. And one way of thinking of different contexts is different spheres of these transnational relationships. So in this article, I look at transnational morality, so people's sense of what's right and wrong in the context of transnational relationships. Their attempts at imagining the other side of the transnational social field. Because even if there is, in a way, a single social arena, people are still separated by long distances, and they can't observe directly what goes on at the other side. And they have to base their ideas on things they hear or things they have seen if they have visited, or in other ways, trying to complete the blanks and imagine what goes on at the other side. And in the article, I also looked at how the relationship is shaped by differential access to resources. And of course, in most cases, it's the fact that migrants are better off. They have money that they can remit and so on. And also they have passports that make them more mobile in many cases. But there are also resources that sort of favor the non-migrants, for instance, in terms of language and cultural skills. Many second-generation migrants who went back on holiday, for instance, were frustrated that they weren't seen as, in a way, authentic Cape Verdeans because they lacked the complete cultural and linguistic proficiency of the real Cape Verdeans who stay there. So we can also think of that in terms of resources. So here's one example of a quote. He said, "I have a grandmother in Gabon, I have aunts in Holland, I have cousins in America, I have a lot of relatives in Portugal, not only there, in a lot of places, but none of them helped man. They never sent anything." And this becomes meaningful when I tell you that I had only asked him, so do you have relatives abroad? And then this was his response. And so he starts off by accounting for, you know, who they are and where they are. And then without being prompted by me, he moves into this complaint about the lack of help, which illustrates the sense of entitlement to help that comes directly from the fact that, you know, he's left there and they migrated. So that's the core aspect of this intrinsic asymmetry, that by leaving, the migrants sort of acquired this obligation to assist. And that, you know, he doesn't feel entitled to this help because of some particular type of relationship or because he did something for them, but simply because they are migrants and he is not. And that's something that I observed in Cape Verde, but also saw echoed in literature from many other places. Here, moving on to the area of imaginations, my brothers call mom every month, sometimes twice a month, depending on, you know, they're very busy. But sometimes if they haven't called for more than a month, mom gets crazy. She thinks that something must have happened, God forbid. So this, of course, illustrates the powerlessness of the people who stay behind and are worried for what might happen abroad that they don't know about. And also this reference to they are very busy says something about, you know, her way of thinking of her brother's life abroad. And a lot of the tensions or difficulties in these transnational relationships had to do with people imagining what went on the other side, and not fully trusting the accounts of the people themselves, and also, yeah, this powerlessness of not knowing. But of course, this is equally frustrating for the other side. So this guy who might have been her brother, or like someone in a similar position, said that my father, three brothers, and grandmother are in Cape Verde. They hardly ever call. It's you who have to call. It's this thing in Cape Verde. It's you who are here, you who have to do everything. They just wait. Wait for you to call, wait for you to send money. So we can see, you know, it's the exact same logic of the first guy who was waiting for them to help him, but it's seen from the other side. And so we can see that they're both frustrating, and they're both, like, it's frustrating from both sides, but the logic of the relationship is echoed by both statements. And here from the Cape Verde side again, when the immigrants come and people say, your aunt is here, why should I go and pretend greeting her so that she can give me some small change? She is there, put me there. I'll go and I'll put someone else there too. So this, again, points to this sort of underlying asymmetry of him being expected to go and greet his aunt who's coming back, but also feeling that, you know, why should he do that just out of politeness or because it's expected? And he recognizes that now he is in a position of needing something from her, but he says that, you know, if she would only put him there, then he would move from the position of being someone needing help to someone who could help others. And this connects, of course, to the Melanie Knight's article about the Bangladeshis in Rome and the way in which patron-client relationships are formed. And we have these hierarchies of people helping someone else who would then in turn be helping someone else. And that mobility within these systems is really very much about moving from one side of those helping and being helped relationships to the other side. And here is also very explicit how he sees that mobility would be the key to making the switch. It's if she could put him there, he would then move to the other side of the relationship in the sense of being someone who's providing help instead of requesting help. I also talk about these relationships, yeah, in the context of remittances in an article from 2 years ago, but I'll follow America's cue and move on quickly. So in transnational relationships, it's extremely obvious, I think, when you look at how people talk about the other side and their experiences of it, that there are these asymmetrical relationships, the power relationships that make either migrants or non-migrants have a position of strength in relation to each other, but it's not consistent which way it goes. And also that these relationships are shaped precisely by mobility and immobility, and also that they are formed by this surrounding context of institutions, and that, for instance, that there are these value systems from which some people can draw a kind of moral capital that affects their relationship with other people, and also, of course, the institutional aspects of migration control that makes it so important, for instance, to have someone who can put you there, as he said. I'm just thinking how to move ahead with the greatest speed. One possible recent trend in migration studies that I know some of you have also been interested in is the increasing interest in temporalities of migration and the temporal perspective and experiences of temporalities in migration. And I think the temporal dimension is also very important to understanding the micropolitics of individuals. And I've done that the most in relation to trying to understand how families are not just transnational at any point in time, spread out in space, but that these transnational relationships change over time. And I've used a diagram to work with that. That I've written about this in a chapter in this handbook of migration research methods that Carlos Vargas Silva has edited. But I'll just briefly show the idea that you have different locations, for instance, an origin and a destination, so representing space sideways like this, and time vertically here from, say, 1980 to 2000 and something. And in a diagram like this, you can trace the movement of individuals. So someone who was, for instance, born in 1991 and then in 1998 migrated from A to B and then stayed there from there on. And I use this in my own fieldwork to really map complex migration histories of families and to talk about what went on at the different stages. So this is not for you to really relate to the detail, but to show you I think an important aspect of it. So this is what a family history might look like with different locations in Cape Verde and different locations in Europe, and people moving at different points in time and then separating from each other or coming together in the same place. And my interest here is in this woman called Denise, who is sort of about my age, who, when she was two, her mother migrated to Italy and sent her along with her sister to stay with her grandmother at another island. Then, when she was 11, the grandmother died and she was moved back to Saint Vincent, where she was born, while her sister stayed on in the grandmother's village with another family. And then, when she was 28, she had a daughter of her own by that time, but she left for Europe, first on a tourist visa to the Netherlands and then to Italy, where she rejoined her mother. And here she left her daughter behind in the care of someone in Saint Vincent. And the point here is that when you look at not just the migration history of a person, but the migration history of a family, and consider both people in relation to each other and people in relation to social environments, we see that these different junctures at different ages in her life are sort of packages of separations and reunions. So at the age of two, she was separated from her mother and from the place where she grew up. She came to a new place and lived with her grandmother for the first time, but being with a sister provided a sense of continuity. And then at 11, her grandmother dies, so losing that, losing the community where she had grown, spent most of her childhood, and also being separated from her sister and entering a new environment in the city where she was born that she hadn't lived in since she was two. And then at 28, leaving Cape Verde for the first time, leaving her own daughter, also leaving her sister, who had in the meantime moved to the city with her, and then coming to Europe and also living with her mother again for the first time since she was two. And what I concluded from this, from all these interviews, was that often the reunions could be as problematic as the separations, and also that separations, of course, didn't only depend on the person herself moving, but also on people around her moving. So I think, in terms of thinking of what immobility and mobility really constitutes, this helps to see how there are different breaks in people's lives that have to do with mobility and immobility, but as these sort of complex packages. And to make it micropolitical, of course, we have to think about what are the power relationships governing these moves, who decides, who experiences these different ruptures and reunions at different points of time. And here, of course, the sort of generational power structures are very important, but also the institutional frame in the form of norms about, for instance, whether it's good or bad for a mother to leave her child to work abroad. I'll skip the summary and move to the last point on chain migration, which I alluded to in the case of this guy who asked for his aunt to put him there so he could help someone else too. That, of course, is the essence of chain migration, that you migrate and help someone else follow in your footsteps. This is something that we were interested in the Themis project that was run out of IMI for several years until recently, and the book just came out before Christmas that Oliver and some others edited, where I have one chapter called Making and Breaking a Chain, Migrants' Decisions About Helping Others Migrate. And here the point is that that's actually a very important decision for migration processes, because it's whether it's about family migration or refugee flows, having someone there at the destination to help you can be decisive to whether or not you're actually able to go. But what the research showed was that actually also the decision to request help or not is important. So there has been for 20 years the idea that migrants play this gatekeeper role in controlling who else gets to migrate or not. But it also makes a big difference in a way who comes knocking at the gate, in the sense of, do you ask someone to help you migrate or not? And whether or not you do, of course, partly has to do with your personality. The potential beneficiary is the person who is a prospective migrant who might be asking for help. Some people are very reticent about asking for help from others, and other people are not. But also these attributes of the potential migrant is affecting the decision to actually offer help or not, in the sense that if you know that this person will cause you trouble if he or she comes, you might not. If you think he or she will bring benefits to you, maybe you will. And also, this should be the potential provider. Attributes of the person who could be providing help will also decide whether or not they actually do it, and whether or not someone asks for help in the first place. I tried to make sense of this with our survey data, and it was possible to see several patterns. For instance, that in some cases there was a clear pattern that people who had themselves received help in their own migration were more prone to help others also migrate. But again, it comes back, I think, to how people are differently positioned in relation to each other, and the possibilities for using those differentials in power to help others migrate or stay immobile. And also that the institutional settings matter, for instance, in terms of family norms and family relationships for that produce some kind of expectation of reciprocity at the family level, which underpins some of the chain migration, in the sense that you're obliged to help someone from that family migrate because of the longer term reciprocity between the families. So then we get to a conclusion. First, that micropolitics matter. I think often when we think about politics and migration, we're at a different level, more at the institutional macro level. The decisions that are made at the micro level are also political, in the sense that they have to do with power relationships and with strategizing and navigating difficult terrains. When we think about migration and micropolitics, migration can either be the cause of these different power relationships between individuals, they can be the effect of those power relationships, or they can just be a circumstance that, migration can be a circumstance that's necessary for understanding what it is that's going on. I said also at several points that even when we're interested in relationships between individuals, it's important how those relationships are underpinned by links to institutions, and either in the sense of formal institutions or value systems, etc. And finally, that it's important to think about each person as having different relationships to other people in different directions. So people that we might, from one perspective, see as relatively powerless, for instance, as low-skilled immigrant workers, could at the same time be in a relatively powerful position vis-a-vis their non-migrant counterparts in the country of origin. Yes. Thank you. Sorry that I was over-ambitious with the content.